Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this evening's event. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Charlie Bean, Professor of Economics here at LSE, although previously Deputy Governor at the Bank of England, in which capacity I came to know tonight's speaker, Jaime Caruana, well. Jaime has been the General Manager of the Bank for International Settlements since April 2009. Before that, he was financial counsellor to the managing director and director of monetary and capital markets department at the International Monetary Fund. From 2000 to 2006, he was governor of the Banco de España, that's Spain's central bank, for those of you who don't know. And in that capacity, he also served on the governing council of the European Central Bank. He was chairman of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision from 2003 to 2006 and has been a member of the Financial Stability Board since 2003. Before he went to the Bank of Spain, Jaime had a long career in the private sector in the financial side. Finally, I think it's worth mentioning that he's a member of the Group of 30, which is a select group of eminent policymakers, financiers, and academics whose purpose is to deepen understanding of major economic and financial issues. Well, his talk tonight, as you can see, is entitled Credit, Commodities, and Currencies, and it analyzes the forces underlying three major contemporary economic developments: slowing growth, especially in emerging economies, as credit cycles mature, large movements in exchange rates, again often afflicting the emerging economies, and finally falls in commodity prices, especially that of oil, which has been accompanied by more general financial turbulence in recent months. And at the conclusion of his talk, he's going to draw out some of the implications of these events for policymakers. For any Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hash LSERC. It's on the bottom of the slide here. Can I also ask you please to put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event? This evening's event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to there being no technical problems. And finally, in the unlikely event of a fire alarm, since we're not intending to have a test at this time of day, if one does go off, you know it's the real thing, and the assembly point is outside Tower 1. As usual, after the lecture, there'll be a chance for you to put your questions to the speaker, but now will you please welcome Mr. Caruana to LSE to deliver his lecture entitled Credit, Commodities and Currencies.
Well, thank you very much for this introduction. It's really, for me, a pleasure, an honor, and also a challenge to be here. I think I was here in this same room 10 years ago, 11. I was here talking about banking regulation. So if any was here at that time, please forget what I may have said at that point of time. World has changed enormously. And I am here today to talk about a completely different topic. But even if it is completely different, it is very much related. And part of what I'm going to say is that we need to look more and more into the interrelationships. And we need to look more and more into what it is going on as a kind of movie that started probably well before even the crisis. Many things have changed, as I was saying, but one thing has not changed, and it is that LSE is at the forefront of economic debates. And again, I remember very well some of the debates that I had at that point of time, and I am looking forward for today's discussion. So a few days ago in our quarterly review of the BIS, we were talking about an easy calm in markets, and certainly this easy calm gave way to a turbulent start this year. We are not really following the day-to-day ups and downs on markets. I don't think that this is what we would like to do. But if I had to summarize some of the developments that are happening today, and I'm sure that you can organize that in many ways, but let's say that we organize around three themes that I have presented here. Disappointing growth, meaning we continually revise the growth that is expected a little bit down. Next year it will be higher than this year, but it will be less higher than it was expected a few months ago. And now at the center stage is the emerging economies that are driving this revision. Then we have seen also large shifts in exchange rates, particularly between emerging markets against the dollar. And obviously we have seen a sharp fall in commodity prices. That has hit enormously, as in significantly, the commodity exporters, but it is also has a positive side, is providing a positive dividend, growth dividend, to other countries. Now, I would like to think and to say that sometimes when we discuss these themes and we read about these themes, these are characterized or presented sometimes as a kind of exogenous shocks and non-related shocks. And what I would like to propose today is that perhaps it's much better to think, to take a very long-term perspective, and when you take a long-term perspective, many of the different shocks seem to be part, again, of the same movie. They have some common elements, and these elements are important to understand what it is happening, and more importantly, to think about future possible developments. There is more endogeneity in some of these phenomena that normally we think, and this is why we talk about a long movie. And one of the things that becomes more evident is the important role that in this movie is the stocks. So one way of one alternative title to this conference could have been is the stocks, not the shocks. So not necessarily is shocks. If we look at the stocks, perhaps we could see some of the interrelationship. And what I am going to try today is to take some of the relationships, some of this interrelationship where the stocks are important. And I think when we take this long-term perspective, we can see slow-moving phenomena that perhaps we are not paying too much attention within the normally policy framework, and we need to pay more attention to that. And one of them is the accumulation of stocks and the accumulation of some imbalances, and others, I would say. And one example that I'm going to talk about is debt, and I will talk about debt. I will talk also about the assets on the other side of the debt, obviously. And I would like to relate this with some of the issues about emerging markets, about commodities, and about currencies. And although I am going to concentrate more on emerging markets, because this seemed to be one of the important elements today, I would like to say that we could do similar analysis in relation to advanced economies, and some of the fragilities also will be in not exactly the same, but different ones, but also looking at the stocks, we will look at fragilities in advanced economies. Now, there is a positive element and a positive message coming out of this analysis is that some of the movements that we have seen, some of the realignments, adjustments, whatever is the name you want to use, may bring some short-term discomfort. We have seen this at the beginning of the year, but to the extent that this is indicating adjustment of the real economy that is necessary, some normalization of the real economy that of the economy that is necessary, this will eventually allow some renewed growth. So what I am going to do today is first an overview of some of the stocks, particularly on debt, on some elements, and particularly I will be talking about debt in emerging economies. relationship with financial developments. I will talk a little bit some of the indicators that we publish in what we call the global liquidity indicators that we publish twice a year at the BIS, and I will concentrate a little bit on the dollar-denominated debt, which is an important part of some of the dynamics that we are seeing now. Afterwards, I will try to make things more confusing, connecting the dots between these recent developments, debt and exchange rate and sovereign risk, debt and oil. And finally, I will try to draw some implications and some policy conclusions. This is going to be a very stylized, and when I say stylized, I mean oversimplified kind of analysis. Behind some of the charts and some of the analysis, there are some research that some people at the BIS have done, and most of it is published, and you can, if you want to deepen on some of these things, Hune is one of the ones that has contributed to many of these pieces, but there are quite a number of research, a number of papers that have been published and can be consulted. So let me go to the first real chart in content, and here I am presenting the private credit in emerging markets and advanced economies. I would like to say that, first of all, debt has increased dramatically since the crisis all over the place. When you look at overall figures, there are exceptions. You can look at private debt in UK. This has been decreasing. It has been decreasing in United States. It has been decreasing in Spain, in some of the countries that were hit, where private debt has come down significantly. Overall, when you add up private debt and public debt, you will see a significant increase. Public debt basically in advanced economies, private debt basically in emerging market economies. And I'm here concentrated on private debt. And you can see here that from 2009 to the present situation, on the left panel, you can see that the non-financial private sector debt has increased by 50 points, and while, as I said, in the advanced economies, basically is a slightly decline or horizontal line. Now, these lines are misleading in the sense that if you would look into it, into details, you will find countries that have grown significantly the debt and countries that have. So it's a very wide range of situations. If you look, for example, at the G20, two countries have decreased private debt more than 20 percentage points of GDP, and seven have increased more than 20% of GDP their debt. So it's a wide range. Now, two cases that I have put before anyone asks that are always in the press, China and Brazil, two rapid growing private debt. And perhaps the substance is on the non-financial corporate debt, the right one, where you can see that the growth has been very rapid and that the growth in emerging markets, corporations have been issuing significant amount of debt to the point that have even increased above, is now above the level of the mature economies. Now, what are the assets on the other side that are financed with this rapid debt? There has been an analysis on about 280 emerging market companies that have issued bonds in international markets, and these companies have been analyzed in terms of their balance sheet to see what are the assets, what have been the investment that has been done with debt. And you can see that the leverage, first of all, that the leverage has increased. And importantly, if you look at the center panel, you can see that the non-tradable sectors, in fact, has the debt has increased, even the leverage has increased even larger. So it's not only what you could think it is commodity producers that have indebted, it's also companies that are working in non-tradable sectors that have increased significantly the leverage. And on the right side, you can see what has happened in terms of profitability. Profitability has come down. This is indicating one of the messages that is some of these credit cycles are maturing in emerging markets, and this is part of what it is happening. And we can see that profitability of those investments have come down, and it is now even lower, having been above advanced economies, now have come lower than it is in the advanced economies. Now, again, should we be, or how much should we be concerned about that? We all know that debt is, some debt is helpful. It helps to smooth consumption. It helps to offset demand shocks by reallocating spending over time. It helps and allows firms to invest faster than their cash flow, so it's a positive thing. But at the same time, in this crisis, if we are talking about investment, we have not seen that much real investment in the world. So what is happening? And that's one question. And the other thing is that when you analyze this crisis or you analyze this stress in markets, you see that one of the good indicators ex ante of what is going to happen is credit growth. So these two things make you ask again whether should we concern or should not we concern. And I am going to to say three reasons why at least we should not be complacent, which is something that we at Central Banking would like to say and repeat, not to be complacent. Okay, we should not be complacent for three reasons. First, because borrowing adds to the stock of debt, and again, stocks matter, and when the stocks get to some level, there are some indications, some empirical evidence that it can act as a drag to growth. And to the empirical evidence that have been analyzing this, we have added recently another piece of research at the BIS that indicates a relationship between the credit booms and productivity growth. And we have seen that productivity growth is damaged by credit booms. And importantly, before, during the credit booms, and importantly, after the credit booms, and for some time. And this credit growth is the productivity growth is reduced for in relation to a non-boom situation, and perhaps the channel is misallocation of resources. Resources are allocated to sectors that have lower productivity, and the result is lower productivity in the economy. And you may say, okay, well, that's not that new. True. There are misallocation in credit booms. But when we have tried to measure that, the amount of reduction of productivity growth is quite significant. And I would leave you to look into a paper that was published in January. This is not today's topic. But my second point, why we should be at least not complacent, is because of the link between debt and risk-taking. And this can can change and turn the financial cycle quite rapidly, quite abruptly. In the booms, I think investors get a false sense of security, but when the cycle matures and assets start to fall, then debt becomes less sustainable. Everything becomes much more rapid, and you can accelerate the deleveraging and capital outflows. And my third reason is one of the components of this borrowing, which is borrowing in dollars. And the fact is that during this period of time, debt was increasing, but one particular segment was debt in dollars that was increasing. And this is one of our preferred charts at the BIS, and we are following this figure. On the world is the debt in dollars held by non-residents in the United States. So it's someone that has issued dollars, but it is not resident in the United States. And the figure has increased rapidly and now is $9.8 trillion. And one of the things that we have seen is that it has been continuously growing, except last quarter, which has stabilized, and that could be indicating that there is some tightening on the financial conditions looking at this stock that started to peak. And this creation of dollars and dollar debt, dollar liabilities doesn't need to come from the United States, and in fact some of them it comes from banks that are not in the United States. So this is a dollar debt, not necessarily by American banks. Now, what is the part of emerging markets? The part of emerging markets is $3.3 trillion. And here what we are adding up, in both cases, what we are adding up is household is private corporations and sovereigns. There is no banks. There is no included in this Now, I was saying that some of the figures are starting to peak. Some of the figures are starting that that could indicate that financial conditions are tightening. You can see financial conditions tightening in terms of quantities more clearly in the US dollar cross-border, banking cross-border claims. And you can see that if you take some of the economies, you can see that the amounts outstanding are starting to decline. This is another indication of some tightening. Tightening can be in two ways. One is the dollar as moving up, but the other way is in the quantities, and you can see that also in the here in these quantities. Now, this is just a chart to show you that you took look not at the dollar debt outside of the United States, but just total dollar debt. That would be the first chart on the left. You can see the brown or yellow part. This is in United States, so it's dollar debt in United States. And the other two segments are the 9.8 that I was mentioning. So it's a small part, but it's a growing and a significant part in any case. And perhaps the most interesting part is on the right side, which is the rate of growth. And you can see that consistently since the crisis, at least the debt securities issued by not residents in dollars have been much higher than the credit to residents in dollars in the United States. Same monetary policy having more effects outside of the country than inside of the country. Now, what is the use of these assets, of these dollars that they have issued, these corporations? One thing that they can do is obvious. They need to buy some other foreign assets. That would be normal. You issue dollars, you buy some company or whatever. But this is not the only reason. In fact, there has been a lot of dollar issued that has been financing investing in their own countries, in a different currency. If it is a company that, for example, produces oil, there is some partial edge or some edge because they are going to get revenues in dollars. But this is not necessarily always the case. And in addition, we have seen that part of the dollars that have been issued have been deposited, have been used to invest in financial assets. For example, they issue dollars, and part of it they deposit as a deposit in their own currency, in their own country. Or they buy a liability of a shadow bank, short-term liability of a shadow bank, which means is some kind of carry trade. What it is carry trade in a bank, but not done by banks, is done by commercial companies, by industrial companies, that perhaps they are waiting for investment in the future. There may be other reasons, but this is what happened. Now, the point is that when situations reverse and the dollar exchange rate moves or interest rate move, they will have the same incentives that the carry trade to unwind, and this would affect also financial conditions in the in their own countries. So we have looked so far to the stocks, emerging markets, dollar debt, and I would like now to start to try to connect some of the dots, connect the dollar debt with the weakness, with the dollar debt with movements in the exchange rates. So this chart shows the strong link between dollar strength and weakness and emerging market borrowing. You can see on the right side just a description of the evolution of the dollar in nominal effective rates. And you can see the weakening of the dollar and then lately the rapid move up, strengthening of the dollar. I think in the two other panels, what we show is the relationship of whether the dollar is moving up or moving down with the flows to emerging markets. And as the dollar weakens, it encourages borrowing in dollars. And there are, as a consequence, a stronger flows into emerging markets. If you look at the central panel, the shaded bands is the quarters where there has been some depreciation, and it is when the flows are larger, and the opposite happens in the other quarters. So what it says is when the dollar is weakening, this is leading to a rapid rise in dollar debt, and when the dollar starts to strengthen, as it is the present situation, because there is a shift in U.S. monetary policy and an expectation of that, there is a reaction in terms of markets and in terms of risk-taking that changes significantly the flows, changes significantly the conditions in emerging markets. So, and these amplification mechanisms that amplifies the deleveraging, it is very risk-sensitive in the sense that the small movements can move rapidly these kind of flows. There are mitigants, and I think it would be important to mention that there are significant mitigants to these mechanisms, mitigants of these concerns. One of them is that many firms that have issued this dollar have dollar cash flows, as I mentioned, and therefore they are able to manage the dollars that they have in their balance sheet as a liability with this to service the debt because they have inflows. There is another one, which is that some of the dollars that have been issued, the debt that has been issued, is long-term debt, and in fact is improving their... They may have improved in their structure. They issued long-term debt, and perhaps they are replacing some of the short-term debt that they have with banks. So there is some elements, but of course we have seen that the debt has increased, so this is only part of it. But they have long-term maturities. That's a positive and a mitigant effect. And most importantly, emerging markets do hold today a significant amount of additional reserves, and that is also a significant caution. But our point is that, yes, there are mitigants, but we should not underestimate the feedback loop between the deleveraging, this risk-taking working in reverse, this deleveraging in emerging markets when their domestic currency is depreciating. First, because there may be these carry trades that I was mentioning before that will affect accelerate exchange rates and will affect tightening financial conditions in the country. And also, even if there is no distress in terms of servicing the debt, what it will may happen is that these companies are under pressure and they will invest less, they will hire less, and they will affect the economy, the broader economy. And that will be another feedback. And then there is an additional effect that is that depreciation of emerging currencies has an effect on sovereign creditworthiness. And this chart shows that and shows the two dimensions. One is the cross-country dimension, and the other one is the evolution. You can see first in terms of time evolution how, as the dollar has been strengthening, the different countries, each country is represented there, and this the amount of the circumferences is really the debt that they, the private debt. Everything has moved as the dollar moves. The CDS, that is a measure of the risk of the sovereign, has started to increase, and that's the time dimension. There is also a cross dimension among countries, and you can see that they create a line. The more they have the value, the more has increased the sovereign risk represented by the CDS. This is another kind of relationship, and although most of the countries that are represented here are oil producers, the truth is that in the paper that was published and that it's at your disposal, this mechanism is also working for those that are importing, which is an interesting. And it affects not only the CDS, but also affects the spreads which is another measure. Now, part of the explanation has to do with oil prices and the relationship between debt and oil prices, and this is going to be my last kind of trying to connect it points, out of dots. There is a big impact on commodity prices fall, but this is not only for emerging markets, it's also obvious for U.S. shale producers. For example, it is related more to the fact that some of these companies are highly leveraged. So the common element is the leverage, is the stock of debt of these companies. And I think there was a very interesting article of Spencer Dale recently saying that there is a debt-driven model for the oil sector, and he was talking about the new credit channel in the oil market. Of course, the oil is a very complicated market, and we are not trying to explain what is happening in the oil market. We are just trying to say that perhaps part of the dynamics that we see could be as an additional effect, as an additional amplifier mechanism, be explained by the relationship of the oil prices and debt in the following way. We've seen how these oil firms have borrowed significantly. They have borrowed in a significant amount. Here you have the figures. I will not get into detail. I think I will move a little bit faster. We can go back to that. But really the main message is they have increased their leverage, in part because they can borrow a lot, in part because they have assets, which is the oil reserves, and against that they have been able to lever. Of course, when the price of oil start to come down, situation start to be a little bit more complicated. And I think you can see that in this chart, particularly just look at the right part. When the oil start to come down, you can see a number of effects. You can see that there is a significant increase in the cost of borrowing, the cost of this debt. And this is hurting a number of things. We already mentioned that it is hurting their capacity to invest, their capacity to hire. But some of these companies, particularly in emerging markets, are public companies, and their revenues, their dividends to their budget are a significant part of the budget. And when you get these less revenues, what you are hitting also is the capacity of the budgets to manage this kind of situation. And in fact, some of the emerging markets have been hedging and have been adjusting their budget significantly. But even those that have been hedging, the hedging normally is short-term, and they have to adjust and to cut back some of the investing. So I've tried to show some of the relationship. I've tried to explain our view, which is that we need to take a long-term perspective, and by taking a long-term perspective, we can explain some of the mechanisms, some of the characteristics of the economy. It is already 8 years since the crisis, and the economy has found it extremely difficult to get to a sustainable and balanced growth. And again, recovery has been extremely modest. This episode is emerging markets for a number of reasons, with all the adjustment that I have mentioned and all these interrelations that I have mentioned. But again, this is part of a long movie, and during this time, stocks have been building up, and it is becoming more difficult to manage this long stocks, and to manage when the situation reaches the point in which the cycles start to mature. Again, to the extent that these transformations and realignments help to correct these imbalances and to slow down this debt, I think this is a welcome path towards normalization. But we have learned that these processes are not smooth and not linear, pose significant challenges. And these challenges can be managed, and hopefully we are wiser in terms of managing that because we have had a lot of experience on that. But we may be tempted to think that the trick is to continue to keep financial booms going, and we don't think that this is the case. This would be really palliatives and not trying to solve the real underlying problems. And we hopefully think that we are, again, better prepared, but the challenges are, we know that the challenges of maturing cycles are difficult, and this takes me to my last two remarks, that is more related to policy that we have been, policy prescription that we have been saying at the BIS, and that probably I am doing here a little bit of a jump and I am getting a little bit of more altitude in these two conclusions. And the first one would be that we need to a more balanced combination of policies, that monetary policy that sets to some extent the price of leveraging has been overburdened for too long, that monetary policy has been used in an asymmetric way through different financial cycles. And we need to pay much more attention to the impediments to growth that are not necessarily solved by monetary policy. And we need to pay more attention to this slow-moving building up of imbalances, building up of debt that at the end are difficult to manage. We have seen bumpiness, and bumpiness is something that probably we are going to see. It is more bumpy when you have significant stocks of debt and we have more debt, so there will be some bumpiness. Bumpiness is going to be expected and should not be a reason to delay the process of normalization that at the end it has to happen. And that's one of our conclusions that we have been saying for some time. There is a second kind of conclusion that we have been mentioning, and it is the need to recognize and internalize something that I have been talking about, which is the importance of spillovers and spillbacks, spillovers from monetary policy to the global condition, from global conditions to the different policies of different countries that contribute to some of the cycles that we have seen, and this at some point of time spill back to the world economy. The principle of keeping house in order is a very sound principle, and it's absolutely necessary. You have to have your house in order, but we think that in this world this is not enough. And if we want to make sure that we don't repeat the same kind of processes, and it seems that we have very serious difficulty to start to growth without being fueled by credit, this is something that it's difficult. And we should be looking at other issues such as productivity growth, etc. But again, if we want not to repeat this kind of issues, it is important that in addition to keep your house in order, policymakers do also look to keep the neighborhood in order. And in that sense, cooperation and central bank cooperation, it will be important and very important. I will stop here. What I would like to say is that I've mentioned some of our views that we are still investigating, that we are still researching, and we will need all the help of an institution such as the EU and the LSE to confirm, to go against, or to see what are really the mechanisms that are driving some of the forces that we are seeing in the global economy. But financial cycles, spillovers, these are areas and stocks these are areas that we need to understand much better than in the past. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jaime. The floor is now open for questions. If you can wait till you get the mic. When you get the mic, please say your name and affiliation and try to keep your question reasonably short and precise rather than giving a speech of your own.
Thanks. I'm Dan Hinge from Central Banking. I wondered, if you've spoken mostly about US dollar-denominated funding this evening, but I wondered if you've seen similar patterns in other currencies, so perhaps a shift from, you know, US dollar funding to euro funding or something similar.
Yes, and we published that figures too. However, these are significantly lower, both in absolute terms and in relative terms, so I don't remember the figures. But they are, I mean, you have it because we published that, but it's significantly lower. And perhaps now it would be becoming more important, funding in euros. That may be a trend that could start now. But so far we have seen some, but not as significant and certainly not so important in the dynamics that we are seeing today.
My name is Rupert Goodwin. The question I have is, are you concerned about any change in the level of debt and the change in the speed or otherwise of population size? So do you see any relationship between the change in population sizes in these different regions and the amount of debt that they're carrying?
Well, that's I'm not sure how to answer that question, frankly speaking. I think we are looking at debt from the perspective of financial stability, and from that perspective, I think the important elements that we have covered is this relationship with the assets that they have on the other side and the dynamics with exchange rates, etc. Of course, I think you have a point, and it depends a lot on the dynamics of the population. And in any case, it will be the data that we are using is in relation to GDP, and GDP also should be in somehow related to growth of GDP should be related to growth of population. We have not looked at that variable, and we could do that to see if our conclusions differ in when we look from that perspective. I have the impression that probably not too much.
Down here.
Isabel Mateo-Silago from BlackRock. Thank you for the fascinating lecture. So one of the conclusions you drew was the need to recognize and internalize international spillovers and spillbacks. So considering that, what do you think the Fed should do right now, given that with this overhang of dollar debt around the world, if it moves aggressively or even not aggressively but steadily, this is going to have adverse impact for the rest of the world?
Well, I'm very sorry, but the questions that I don't answer is what central banks should do. And I would say two things. One is we don't answer these questions as a matter of principle. Second, even in our analysis have a different perspective, and we are not looking in the same kind of time span that they are looking. We are looking medium term. I think this is necessary. Someone has to look at the medium term, and I think the central banks have to look in more short term, and therefore is a different perspective. But in any case, I will not answer that.
Down here in the front.
Marcus Schüler, I represent Market. Jaime, you mentioned some mitigants for the issuance of dollar-denominated debt, and you mentioned that it could be longer dated, or there could be a natural hedge because you have cash flows in dollars. The one potential mitigant you didn't mention was if you might want to issue in the dollar market because it's the most liquid market and you can get big-size long-term funding. But if you didn't like the currency risk, you might want you might have decided to hedge your dollar exposure. Do we have any information about to what extent this foreign dollar-denominated debt has been hedged by the issuers?
Yeah, I think what we have seen is that there is some, but there is and some of the dollar hedge are short term, and therefore they do not cover too much. And in that sense, we don't think that we think that the phenomenon that we are describing are at play, and they are not completely complete mitigants. There are more mitigants, frankly speaking. If we were so, we have mentioned a number, but you could do more than that. And for example, there has been some actions by central banks whereby they have auctions that whereby they finance and provide the dollars that some of the private sector is needed. That's another way of mitigating some of the risk, and this has happened. But in any case, this is not simple. And when the central banks are in this situation, normally they need to do that. But in addition to do that, they need to present a package of additional reforms in order to get the market dynamics in a more stable way. So, as I said at the beginning, this is a very stylized and very. Yes, we have looked at that. I think this will help a bit, but it will not solve the issue.
Over there, please.
And over there, there was another.
Hi, my name is Mark Boland. I'm an Africa Middle East economist at Bloomberg Intelligence. So I also have a question relating to these points with these sort of international spillovers and spillbacks. I mean, there is Helen Ray, who you're probably quite familiar with, you know, just touching on this area of this, you know, trillions of dollars just sloshing around the economy and very much on quite short-term horizons. And the sort of topic of capital controls has come back into a sort of international framework, at least a discussion. And what is your sort of vision on that, or what's your view on that? And maybe not, I'm just thinking of sterilizing to sort of avoid some of the more the short-term money, which arguably maybe adds more volatility rather than actual lowering interest rates and supporting investment.
Well, I think we tend to think that, yes, there are more instruments and you have capital controls, capital flow management, as it's now said. You have macroprudential policies. You can use these policies. We tend to think that capital controls or management of flows are measures that may need to be used, but most on a temporal basis and as a way of acting in other policies so that you can correct part of the problems. But we must recognize that we live in a world in which, again, a lot of stocks and therefore the capacity of flows to move, and it may be necessary and it has become more acceptable to use these tools in some occasions. But I think when someone uses these tools, have to think really how sustainable these tools can be and therefore use it as a temporary to look for deeper solutions if these are available. So I think it is not a definite answer, but I would say that, yes, everybody agrees that this may need to be used at some point of time, but I would not look at that as a definite solution for some of these flows problems.
Well, front here. Jeffrey, wait for the.
I wonder if you could explain a little bit more about central bank cooperation more important than ever. Yeah. What does that mean, you know, in terms of you?
Well, it means. It means a lot of things. It means that we, first of all, we need to recognize that some of the analytical framework that we have to analyze the spillovers and the spillbacks is not that good, and probably we are underestimating some of these effects. So I would say that as a first step, we all together need to work a little bit more in some of this analytical framework. It means that there is a first level of cooperation, and obviously we at the BIS, this is the main mission. We is exchanging of views, exchanging of information. So that would be the first level. We would like to see another level in which, if we are able to look at these new analytical frameworks in which we could be, let's say, converge views and have a more clear view on how these mechanisms of spillovers, of spillbacks could work. If we would reach this second stage, it would be then perhaps possible that in a self-enlightened interest, some central banks will internalize some of these spillovers and spillbacks. And I think we would need to improve, and this is not a simple, it's much more easy to say that than to do that. But we tend to think that if we were able to improve this analytical and demonstrate and see evidently what are these spillovers and spillbacks, probably this cooperation will be simpler. Let me say what I don't think that it is cooperation. I don't think that cooperation is some institution deciding on a worldwide what is going to be the policy, the monetary policy. We are not thinking of this kind of thing, and we are not thinking that central banks should sit together and negotiate or agree on what are going to be the measures. So this is not what we are thinking. What we are thinking is sharing information and really try to understand much better than we do at this very moment what are the spillovers and spillbacks, and internalizing this into your own decisions. And if you internalize that, probably in this self-enlightened interest, you will be thinking that probably some of your measures will have effects in others, and this will make it back, get back to you. And perhaps this would be a better way of... And we have seen that, but it's a very complex, proposition, I know that.
There was one at the back there.
Hello. So I know that you touched a little bit about regulation, and as someone that works in OTC clearing, it keeps me employed. So I wonder if you could speak a bit about what you think maybe the best regulation, what you've seen that's come out since the crisis that you think has been effective, and what you think might still need to be done from a regulatory perspective.
That's a very general question. I think the most important thing probably is you need to look at systemic risk, and I think this is what most of the regulations have tried to do. I would put a second principle, that we are living in a very complex system, and complex systems are difficult to manage, but one of the lessons of complex systems is that the best way to manage them is to be prepared ex ante, before the dynamics start. When the dynamics start, is very difficult to manage. So it's much better to have capital before. If you have cushions, if you have capital, you will be able to manage these complex situations. But this has to be ex ante before the dynamics. It's very difficult to do it when things start. So with these principles, I think there has been a lot of thinking about what was necessary. And frankly speaking, at this point of time, after 7 years and many years of doing and changing regulation and improving the regulation, and we can go, if you want, we can go through the different pieces and parts of this regulation. I think what we need to do now is to conclude the regulatory reform. And I think this is the objective that regulators have today, and the objective is to conclude it soon, and there is clear wish to conclude what it is open at this point in the table. Still, there are a number of very important elements that need to be concluded, but there is not any appetite for additional opening up additional avenues of regulation.
Another one at the front, and then I have a couple on the other side of the aisle.
Robert McRae. You spoke of a financial realignment, but if we've seen developed market currencies strengthen relative to emerging market currencies, this seems to suggest increased confidence in developed market economies relative to developing market economies. So do you see this as indicating the success of the stimulative policies pursued by developed market central banks over the last 6 or 7 years?
I would see that there are many mechanisms at play, as we have seen. I think it is partly the expectations of the changes in monetary policies and expectations about what is the situation of the different economies. But I was trying to say that in addition to that, there are mechanisms that will amplify and that has amplified some of these effects, and the leveraging sometimes amplified these effects. So it is difficult always to say what is the equilibrium, and certainly we are not in that in that camp to define that. What we are interested is what are the dynamics that are moving this kind of exchange rates.
Elena Rybakova from LSE's Institute of Global Affairs. I wanted to ask you whether changes introduced by Dodd-Frank, in your view, made the spillover effects more pronounced than the systemic risk, or it had no unintended consequences beyond the improving regulation on the sell side?
I think that one of the things that we, all regulators, are doing is, first, what I said before, we try to conclude what it is on the table. The second thing is we are trying to analyze what are the impact and what are the effects, both intended and unintended consequences. And I think the only way of doing that is once you have... Well, first of all, when preparing these reforms, at least I can speak for Basel, not necessarily for Dodd-Frank, but I think there has been a serious... Probably there has been a significant amount of work trying to measure what would be potential impact. So this analysis had been much better on this occasion than on any other occasion, in part because there was very clear consciousness that the growth was weak and we needed to make sure that what we were doing was positive, etc. So there was a significant amount of work trying to measure what would be the impact. But in addition, we know that the only way to measure that, it will be after. And I think we are all ready, and we are doing analysis of what are happening, what is happening, and what is the unintended consequences. So I don't know what is the answer for that yet, but what I can say is that there will be more and more analysis, and if you follow our pages, you will see significant reports. You can see recently 2 reports about market liquidity. One of the things that we are all concerned to see whether market liquidity has improved and why and what is behind that. You will see several reports from us, but you can see the same published by many other central banks and many other regulators. So this is something that we all know that it is important. And the European Banking Authority is doing also a lot of analysis, and we are all committed to have good regulation, and we need to see what are the intended and unintended effects.
Okay, I have another one on that side of the aisle, then one in the middle of the front row, and then back there.
Hi, Gareth Peters, University College London. So thank you for a very interesting talk. So I just tried to understand your comment there that the regulation at present is somewhat maturing and converging, because what I see at the moment in some of the areas of the regulation, such as in Basel documents for operational risk, for banking book, and for some of the exchange regulations, it seems like there's some significant structural changes that are going on to do with how capital is calculated in banks. So, for instance, the one that I've been looking at in detail is perhaps the proposed removal of AMA, for instance, in Basel regulation. Yeah. This is a significant structural change in the regulation which would influence the capital in many jurisdictions in different ways, primarily in the US and in Europe in different ways. And to me, that doesn't seem like a convergence. So the question is, what's your view on that, and if you could comment on that?
So there has been a significant change in the advanced measurement approach. That's clear. What I am not sure is why you say that there is no convergence, because this has been agreed at the level of the committee at the Basel Committee. So in that sense, there is convergence. It is true what you said, that this has been a significant change, and the change is that this modelling has been abandoned to some extent, and that is a significant change. And the question is, why? Well, because we have seen that this was not working properly, and this has been done after significant consultation, or at least that was the view of the Basel Committee, but there is some convergence from that perspective. I am not sure what was your point. Yeah. I'm frankly speaking, perhaps we can discuss it. I don't follow what is your argument. It's not a what? In US? I cannot answer that question.
Ron Anderson from the London School of Economics. And my question would like to connect to dots between a number of the points that you've made. You've said that you think that the re-regulatory process is hopefully nearing its end. Part of that has involved much more and capital and of better quality. So a recapitalization of the banking sector has been taken very seriously, as we know. But you say that we are facing a prospect of delevering in the emerging markets economy, and that there could be managing the downturn is not easy, and there could be bumps along the way. But you started your remarks by saying that if we take a long-term view, there's some reason for optimism that there's the adjustment process can be managed. So can I infer from this that you think that the level of capital that is now in the banking system or in the pipeline is sufficient to deal with the problems?
Well, I think this is always a probability issue, but the capital has been increased significantly. And perhaps I should have said that one of the mitigants also for emerging markets is that they have a much better capitalized banking system. So in that sense, they are much better prepared than they were before. And I must say that it's not only the regulation. These emerging markets, many of the emerging markets, were very well capitalized even before some of the Basel III measures were done. And they have been very capitalized because they had learned the lessons in previous crises. So I think emerging markets have, for a long time, have been improving their policy framework. They have been strengthening their financial system. And I think this is another plus in terms of managing this crisis. I would say, yes, not to be complacent, that is the sentence that we need to say from time to time, that also the risks are changing, and we need to be aware not only of the last battle, but also to be aware that risks are changing, and we need to be thinking also not only of being prepared for the last war, but being prepared for the next one. And the next one may be more complex in other areas. So we continue to think about what is necessary. But if you are asking me, are they better capitalized? Certainly they are better capitalized. And we will be in a much worse situation had not been the capital increased significantly over this period of time. So I think that's clearly my view. This is a real positive.
Steve Barrow from Standard Bank. Just going back to your presentation, what's the bigger problem? Is it the level of debt or the denomination of the debt? Because in relation to the first question, for instance, as you sort of said, dollar debt is so much greater internationally than euro debt, and obviously still much greater still than any other currency. Would you feel more comfortable if there was a better split between, say, dollars and euros, so the world was sort of less kind of Fed-centric, less dollar-centric? And I suppose, in a sense, sort of supplementary to that, is that if the answer to that is yes, then what's the chances of that, given you know what we've been through in the Eurozone in the last few years?
I think the point was that the important point was that there was debt issues outside of the United States, and it's not a question of whether it's better euros or dollars. I am not sure I understood your question, but I think the important point is, first, the stock of debt matters, and total debt, and in euros, in euro, in dollars, or in any other currency. This matters in one way. And in addition, there are other dynamics that, additional to the other ones, when you are borrowing in a different currency that is your currency, the currency that you have your structure. If you have assets in one currency and you are borrowing in a different currency, it doesn't matter. It is going to be raising a new set of additional problems that go beyond whether you are very highly indebted or not. You have other dynamics that come from exchange rate movements. I don't know if this answers your question. I was not sure I... I think it's not so much whether it's centric on one currency or the other. It's what are this currency doing. If the dollar is moving up and you have liabilities in dollars, you have an issue. If the dollar, you are in euros, it's a different issue. It depends on that. So I am, again.
Are there any more? Final question over there.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to go back to your first slide. You started by saying something very interesting about how the shocks facing the system are not exogenous, that they're more interrelated than we realize. And maybe I'm just thick, but I don't feel like I've got a full explanation of how and why, why you feel that way and how that works. So if we could go back to that, I'd appreciate that.
You want me... the full presentation? No, I think what we are trying to say is that some of the phenomena that we have seen, some of this situation in the economy, have some common factors. And these common factors, for example, is what happened with monetary conditions. Global monetary conditions are relevant for the debt, for the exchange rates, changes on that are explaining many of these things. Financial cycles is one of the things that we have been looking into explain a good part of the situation in terms of why emerging markets are now weaker in terms of growth, because the financial cycle has a peak. This is related to global financial conditions. Global financial conditions are related to monetary conditions, particularly of advanced economies. So there, you need to look at all these factors, and there are some common factors that you could look to these common factors even before the crisis, and you could explain many of the things, many of the stories by looking at that. It's not full explanation, and there are plenty of idiosyncratic elements. I mean, if you are trying to explain China, you will have plenty of idiosyncratic things, any country that you want. But there are some common elements that also help to explain what is happening. And behind all this is the sense that we tend to repeat a pattern of growth that is based too much on fostering debt and fostering credit, and perhaps we are not paying enough attention to the other elements, productivity, growth, etc. It's simpler, but I mean, I have put together everything, and but that's the kind of interrelationship that we are looking for.
Okay, I think we've been treated to a tour de force this evening, stitching together a range of different issues with your distinctive and usual clarity. If you would all join me again in thanking Jaime for taking time out from what will be a very busy schedule while you're in London to come and talk to us this evening.